You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. You know, once upon a time, you needed a scribe to make a copy of something. A real live person, often a monk, for example, would copy in longhand what you wanted to be reproduced. Later, inventions like the printing press brought reading matter to the masses, but there was still no way to make a copy of your tax return, a funny cartoon, Aunt Helga's 8-page sausage recipe. We know now that's an easy thing to do. You just plunk down a few cents at your local library, a drugstore, or a copy shop, or even sometimes you can do this at home with your own photocopy machine. But the idea behind today's modern photocopier, well, it's almost the entire work of one man, Chester Carlson. And believe it or not, as hard as it may seem today, Chester Carlson spent years knocking on doors trying to convince people that photocopying was a good and useful idea. Hey, they'd say, we got carbon paper. We don't need photocopying. What is that? And anyhow, well, how did he succeed and at what cost? That's what we're going to be talking about for the rest of the hour, the story of Chester Carlson and photocopying. Joining me now is David Owen. He's a staff writer at The New Yorker and author of Copies in Seconds, Chester Carlson and the Birth of the Xerox Machine, out this month from Simon & Schuster. He joins us from member station WSHU in Fairfield, Connecticut. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hello, Ira.
You know, I wrote a book about 10 years ago called They All Laughed, and about scientists who were laughed at. And he was a main topic of one of my chapters because I found it so amazing how people laughed at his idea. He couldn't sell this thing, could he?
No, he couldn't. IBM turned him down, Eastman Kodak, GE, RCA, just about anybody, any high-tech company of the 1940s, he approached, and they all said no.
And what was the state of copying at that time? Let's go back to the 1940s or the 30s. How did people make copies of things?
Well, most of the office copying was done with a typewriter and carbon paper,
right,
which wasn't really copying because you couldn't take a document that already existed and use carbon paper to make a duplicate of it.
Mm-hmm.
To copy a document that already existed, there was only one method, and it was about as old as – it was one that Benjamin Franklin used, our assistant to your previous segment.
Yeah.
Franklin, incidentally, tried to make a copying machine, but it was called the copying press, and it was a device – it's the device that most of us think of as a book press, which
I see.
Most of them weren't. It was a – you squeezed a still wet piece of paper against a blank piece of paper, and you made a mirror image of it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the only way to make a – in fact, until just about the middle of the 20th century was the only way to make a legally indisputable copy of an existing document.
A wet, smelly copy of stuff. I remember they used to dry, and you have to wait for them to dry and stuff like that.
Right, and then in the 50s, it was yeah. There was sort of almost the – there was an explosion of copying ideas, and 3M had a machine called the Thermofax, which used light, heat, and there were other processes that were similar
right.
to photography, but they all used coated paper, they all used smelly chemicals,
right.
they
right.
all made bad copies that
right.
weren't permanent, and we're old enough to remember
yes,
those
I'm
things.
Old enough to remember that. but then Carlson came up with an interesting idea of using static charges. In his method, what did he do?
Yes, it's sort of harder to explain in a sentence. I think I explained it in my book, but
yes.
it's basically a combination of electrostatics and photoconductivity. He found a way of shining light on a document and then using the reflection to create an image in electrostatic charges on a mm-hmm. on a plate, and then he would dust that plate with an oppositely charged powdered ink, and it would create a picture of the page mm-hmm. that was being copied. And this is still the way your office photocopier
still
works.
Done.
It's the way your laser
yeah.
printer works. It's never been superseded. It seemed so unlikely at the time that there were physicists who visited the sort of decrepit warehouse in Rochester where the first machines were being assembled, who doubted even then that it was even theoretically mm. feasible. And yet it's probably the vast majority of the printed documents that a of the pieces of paper that an American office worker handles in the course of a given day are produced xerographically because they either come from copying machines or they come from laser printers, which do the same thing but with a sort of a digitally controlled laser as the light source.
But he didn't have a big laboratory to work out. He worked out of the back of his kitchen or something. He really worked in decrepit situations as a lone inventor.
He did. And he wasn't a very good experimenter either. But he had his idea in the New York Public Library. He tried to some early experiments in the coal cellar of the apartment building he lived in unhappily with his wife.
Yeah.
He borrowed her kitchen, which put strains on an already strained marriage. And he pretty much got nowhere for a year or so. And then he hired an unemployed Austrian scientist who worked with him for 6 months, succeeded right away in doing what Carlson had wanted him to. They made a copy, a little copy. It's the size of a business card, and you can see it at the Smithsonian Institution today. And Carlson was thrilled. He'd been vindicated, and his assistant was sort of appalled. He thought it didn't look like much, and they parted ways, and that was that. He didn't see a future in it.
He just made the copy of the word Astoria. He was working out of Astoria, Queens, and a little slide.
It was in Astoria,
right?
Queens, and the date, which was October. It was in October 22nd, 1938.
So he goes around and he says, "I got this. I can make now these dry copies," and he tries to sell it to somebody, and no one will buy it. No one thinks this is a great idea.
There were a number of reasons. One was that the idea was so unusual. One was that Carlson was not a natural salesman. He had grown up in almost unbelievable poverty. He had gotten a bachelor's degree from Caltech, but by overcoming just the sort of odds that nobody overcomes anymore. It's inconceivable. You read it, were people different in those days? But it was he was the main financial support of his family beginning from when he was a teenager. He started working when he was 8. He worked his way through 2 years of junior college, sometimes a dozen jobs, working in a cement plant, sometimes 3 shifts in a row. He worked his way through Caltech while also supporting his father and living with his father, who had been an invalid since Carlson was an infant. And at one point they lived in a chicken coop, and Carlson's father lived inside the chicken coop, and Carlson stayed outside because his father had tuberculosis. He coughed around the clock. Carlson couldn't sleep through the coughing and didn't want to contract the tuberculosis, which had just killed his mother, and he slept outside on the hard ground.
He was tenacious. He knew what hardship was, right? And he wasn't going to let that keep him from getting where he wanted to go.
He had two qualities that were at least deepened by this experience. And one was this kind of stubborn tenacity that he didn't give up. His whole experience of the world was that you don't give up. And the other was that because he had spent most of his life in his own company, he had an unconventional outlook on scientific problems and just on thinking in general. There was at one point when an older cousin of his who preferred Carlson's company to the cousin's college classmates. When Carlson was 12, the cousin pointed out, look, Chet, there's a blackbird over there. And Chet said, "How do you know it's a blackbird? It's black on this side, but how do you know what color it is on the other side?" And that was his it was either a joke it may have been a joke, but it was also, I think, the indicative of the unusual way in which he looked at scientific problems.
Well, he got turned down by all these companies, and he finds a struggling company in Rochester, New York that's run out of its own options, looking for
a
new product.
That's right. Little company, the Haloid Company, that was a manufacturer of photographic papers and other supplies, and it existed very much in the shadow of this high-tech colossus of the era, the Eastman Kodak Company, one of the most successful high technology companies of the time. And the people at Haloid were very interested in finding another line of business, especially the company's president, who was the father of the son of the chairman and the grandson of the founder, and he wanted to establish himself. And through a series of lucky accidents, they got together. Carlson and Haloid got together, and then But even then, it was still years. That was in the mid late 1940s, and the first really functioning office copier, the Xerox 914, wasn't marketed until 1960. So it was from the 1937 when Carlson first thought of the idea until 1960. In fact, by the time the 914 came out, Carlson's original patent on the process had expired. Wow. Fortunately, he had others. He was a patent attorney, and he knew how to protect an invention.
We're talking about the development of the Xerox company and xerography this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. I'm talking with Michael Brian Schiffer, author of Copies in Seconds, Chester Carlson, and the Birth of the Xerox Machine. I'm sorry, David Owen, Copies
That's
in Seconds.
Right. I'll take credit for his book, too.
Yeah, but you... and so that was the birth of Xerox. I mean, they changed the name, from Haloid to Xerox, and that, the rest is history, as they say.
Right. It was funny. It's funny to go back and read through the correspondence when the company was debating over whether to change the name, and it's the kind of change that... the kind of fear of change that you see so often, and employees of the company wanted to, no, we can't get rid of our name. We've been around since 1906. People know us by this name. And of course now nobody knows that name. There was a sort of a compromise. The company in the 50s became Haloid Xerox, and then in 1961, after the astonishing success of the 914, Fortune magazine said it was maybe the most successful commercial product of all time. And it was a truly world-changing.
Did it catch on immediately? Or did it take time to catch on?
It caught on almost immediately, but it did it in the way the video cassette recorder did, which was that nobody really knew what it was for until we had it. Companies were making copies. They were using that Thermofax. They were using carbon paper. They were using some other inexpensive machines that made bad copies on smelly paper. But when the 914 came along, people realized that they can make copies of just about everything. And you go to a committee meeting now, and of course
you wonder how you ever lived without it before. You didn't want the machine,
right? So people suddenly realize, originially the thought was, well, it will replace carbon paper.
Yeah.
Nobody thought about making copies of documents moving in the other direction. I mean, the way memos used to circulate, it had a little slip on it with people's names on it. You'd check it off and pass it on. Now everybody gets a copy.
So did Carlson die a rich, happy millionaire, multi-billionaire?
Well, he made a huge fortune. He was one of the wealthiest people in the United States in the early 60s, and then found that the great wealth wasn't all it was cracked up to be. And he sort of felt for a while adrift, didn't know what his purpose was, what he should do next. And I think sort of reluctantly decided that his new purpose was to give his fortune away. And he spent the last 10 years of his life giving away this phenomenal fortune. And he with huge gifts, he and all anonymously. He wouldn't permit buildings to be named after him. He wouldn't even allow his name to be connected with the gift. And so he did. He would buy, for example, apartment buildings in New York City and Washington D.C. This is in the early 1960s, and so that they could be integrated. He made large gifts to historically black colleges, to organizations that worked for world peace, to all kinds of sorts. Then he also did things like he would quietly pay off the mortgages of impoverished little old ladies. And it became his ambition, he said, was to die a poor man. And his wife said after he died that she thought that his true wealth had been the great number of things that he could easily do without. He never had a second car. He was worth a couple of $100 million in the 1960s. They never had a second car. They never had a second home. When he traveled in Europe, his wife had to persuade him not to buy third-class train tickets. He was unassuming that if someone once asked him where he worked, and he said Xerox, and the person who was an acquaintance assumed that he must work in the factory and asked him if he belonged to the union.
Well, we've run out of time, David. I want to thank you for taking time to talk with us. Fascinating story. David Owen, staff writer at The New Yorker and author of Copies in Seconds, Chester Carlson, and The Birth of the Xerox Machine. It's out this month from Simon & Schuster. Have a good weekend. Thanks for joining us.
You too. Thanks.
Our technical director is Kevin Wade. Our audio engineers are Matt Galick and Rico Cardi in New York and Amanda Vautour in Connecticut. Greg Smith composed our theme music, and we had help today from NPR librarians Key Molesky and Alphonse Vinn. Surf over to our webpage at Science Friday if you missed any of the references. Also, download back editions of Science Friday in your Audible player. Also, you can leave us email at sciencefriday.com. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.